back on the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590. The Fan, Justin and Ailish. It's your baby Friday, Justin.
It is my baby Friday. Off Friday. So off next week.
You get baby Friday on a Wednesday.
It hits similarly.
Must be nice.
It is nice.
No days off over here.
Oh, good for you.
That's right. Josh and I just burying you today. Kipper, former NHL forward, Stanley Cup champ, Kosa Kipper and Born, real Kipper and Born. How's it going this morning, Kipper?
Good morning. Sun's come up for Leaf fans today. That's a good sign.
Did it?
Has it?
Is it murky out there? We don't have windows in this room. We don't know where they're going to bunker here.
Yeah. Rough one last night. And it's really strange. There's some teams that should be coming together and playing maybe some of their best hockey, at times looking desperate. And you look down the league and you're like, well, it's not happening for some teams right now. And I think the Leafs are in that murky place right now.
So what's the explanation then for last night? Is it like late season malaise? Is it the jumbled lines? Is it uneven performances? Like what would be like the explanation for last night's result?
Yeah. I think the one common thing that we've talked about in the last week or since Ryan O'Reilly disappeared was Sheldon going out there and changing it up, to what degree that he's looking for chemistry and he's looking for some magic solution. How many defensive pairs have we seen since the trade deadline? How many different lines have we seen, the combination since the trade deadline? I really believe that he's got to just settle something right down and just stick with it, even if it has stretches where it doesn't look great. That's, I think, the commitment that he needs to make going into the last half a dozen games of the 12 left.
Yeah, it kind of feels like he's introducing unnecessary stressors because things aren't going well, right? Like he's singled out William Nylander. John Tavares clearly isn't playing well. Austin Matthews might be turning things around, but maybe Mitch Marner's not been as good as he has been. And that's, maybe not saying all that much because he's been so brilliant. But if everything's not really going well at an individual level, and then you mix things up to this like extreme extent, it's like, okay, there's already some stress going on, and now things are just overwhelming. And I don't know if it reached overwhelming level last night, but the team looked more frustrated than we've seen. Sheldon Keefe looked frustrated, but guys like Mitch Marner looking frustrated and showing their frustration on the ice. Like, it just seems like it's gone maybe a little bit too far and that the experimentation needs to end.
Yeah. Well, if you want to start with Mitch Marner, he'd be the least of my worries. He's a guy that constantly makes great plays. And I know the one that Leaf fans will be pointing at was the pass up the middle of the ice to Morgan Riley. And yeah, it was not a good pass, but I mean, that's what he's paid to do. And that's what he does most often well, overwhelmingly well over what we saw last night. So there are certain guys that I think he needs to help focus here going down the stretch. And for me, the balance act in all of this is Tavares and Nylander. Those are the two guys. As far as Matthews and Marner is concerned, I think Matthews should fall into that Marner place where you just expect and know that, he should be there for you. But Tavares is not generating 5-on-5. And we can look back and say, on a number of reasons why, but he still has to be that guy that creates offense, and he's done it most of his career. But last night's an example where he's not getting to the middle of the ice. He's not getting quality looks right now, and that has to be a priority, along with Willie Nylander again for Sheldon.
Yeah, Justin raised a good point at the top of our show about maybe it's just a second line right now that is the blender.
The source of all the issues?
Where the blender's being pushed on, the on button, because you can't figure out how to make that second line work. You can find a way to have Mitch Marner amplify this person and that person, but is it for you, once you figure out how to get that second line together, maybe that's, and unfortunately, maybe it's waiting till Ryan O'Reilly or Matthew Nyes, can they afford to wait that long to see if they can fit? And if they do have a second line that works, just the puzzle pieces all fit into place after that.
To answer your question quick, yes, they can afford to wait that long if they have to. And it's not going to be a good feeling to feel like you got to turn a switch on in the last three or four games that Ryan O'Reilly comes back. But, I mean, we saw a really, really quick version of that in Buffalo just prior to Ryan O'Reilly getting hurt. And it looked good. It felt good. And Ryan O'Reilly's such a pro that you assume that once he comes back in, it should fit a lot better than it looked last night. But saying that, Ryan O'Reilly does not play defense, and he's going to have to find a way to, again, settle his defensive pairs last down the stretch, unlike what we saw last night. I mean, I think there's 10 or 12 different pairs of defense we've seen since the trade deadline. I mean, how many more changes can you make before you settle in on something?
Hopefully not too, like, I don't know how many other combinations are out there. It's like you've took out the Rubik's Cube and you've done it all. Someone that is at least mentioning in the media that they like being partnered up with Kelly Yonkroke is Austin Matthews. And he said that a few times, I want to play with this guy. Like, things are going well. And he has been really impressive, I think, over this little stretch, Yonkroke I'm mentioning here. Do you like that little tandem together? And in what ways is, you know, Kelly Yonkroke kind of come into his own here over this stretch and maybe won over the hearts of Leafs Nation, of a guy that, to be honest, I didn't know too much about when they signed him this offseason?
Yeah, I don't mind it in short spurts, but I'll never look at Yarncroc and say that guy's a legitimate top six forward, for me anyways. I think he's a perfect guy that can fall into five, six, seven, but not, you know, not a legit top guy. In saying that, I don't know how long Austin will feel that way moving forward here, because, you know, there are times when he can shoot the puck and he's done it very well. And the majority of his 17 goals have come off line changes sometimes where he's matched up with Willie Nylander or Marner. But, you know, if you can get 15 or 17 goals out of Yarncroc consistently on a third line with a David Kemp or, you know, a Kerfoot, or that to me is a much stronger look for him. But last night, I think, was a prime example that if you went into a game one against Tampa Bay and Yarncroc, you know, doesn't look good on a top line last night. I thought he didn't have a very good game at all. And that's the danger with these guys that are notoriously known as bottom six guys, notoriously known as 15-goal scorer. Like, everybody's marveling at his shot. Where's the shot been for, like, 12 years, right? Like, you know, you're a 15-goal scorer. You're a 17-goal scorer. That's what you are, even with that shot. That should look like you should score 40. Well, you haven't. You know why? Because you're not a top line forward like Sheldon has you right now. Short spurts, yes. And if you can squeeze it out for a week, maybe, okay, I can see it. But long term, I don't like Yarncroc with Austin Matthews.
Yeah, I guess if you're squinting, you're like, okay, can he do Hyman things, but with that shot, score more goals? Before Hyman, you know, ultimately went to the Edmonton Oilers and became like a 100-point guy, like, maybe, and again, maybe it's just for a short spurt, but, like, I think it's definitely wishful thinking if you're just going to put two middle six guys with Austin Matthews. I mean, he started last night's game with Yarncroke and Alex Kerfoot, and I'm trying to figure out, like, where that falls in the experimentation process. Like, he's not actually thinking you're going into a playoff series with Austin Matthews playing with two utility guys, right? Like, that, there's no way that's possible. And then I'm seeing Morgan Riley connected to him a lot, and I'm like, okay, are they just trying to surround Matthews so they can feature Matthews? I'm not really sure if, like, that, where that, like, falls in the experimentation process for you, but is it about Matthews or about, okay, Matthews, just kind of deal with this while we see if we can figure out what we're doing here with Tavares, Nylander, and maybe if those two need Mitch Marner to a certain extent?
Well, I think you're absolutely right in terms of, you're not going to see Austin Matthews with those guys when push comes to shove in the playoffs any more than you're going to see Willie Nylander with Lafferty and McMahon on a consistent third line. And we saw Willie jump back up when things got hairy last night. So, you know, you got to put those guys in positions to succeed. They are your top priority. Like, there is nothing else. If you cannot make your $40 million shine in the first round, and right now he's got a few in Matthews and Marner, but like we said, Tavares and Willie are a concern right now, and he's just going to have to find something and settle in on it and get these guys going.
What's the key to matching the desperation of a team that feels it authentically? Like, you know, the New York Islanders have to win hockey games at this point. Like, it's dire right now. It's life or death. They need to string wins together if they're going to hold on to that wild card position. And they're kind of comfortably there now. Last night's win was a, you know, a big help for them. But you've got, like, it's kind of understandable that you wouldn't be able to match that. But it's on teams like the Maple Leafs to match that and make sure that they're going into the playoffs on a strong note. How do you manufacture desperation? Like, is that really a big challenge for players to understand that, hey, this doesn't really mean much in terms of results, but we need to be at this level? Like, how much of a challenge is that for players?
It appears to be a very big challenge. If I played 12 years professional hockey, I've covered it for like 25 years as a broadcaster. I don't know why they don't feel like they were desperate last night.
Did you always feel it?
Listen, I was the guy that played every day that showed up and said, is this the day they're going to figure out I'm not that good? Is this the day that they stop paying me? Is this the day it's over? So, yeah, I did feel that as an individual. I felt that every day. Am I going to lose my spot? Am I going to get traded, sent down? I felt that. And there was something that never allowed me to relax and feel like I've got my spot solidified. But that's me. I don't know what's going on with some of the kids today and how secure that they feel. If you take a look, Justin, over the whole league, I don't know why a team like Florida, Pittsburgh, Winnipeg, Calgary. I mean, we've got a few teams here. Nashville should still feel like they're still in it. Like, they've played some poor hockey here in the last week, 2 weeks here, and they should feel and look desperate. But it's 82 games. It's hard to maybe generate true emotion for these guys on some nights. They're tired. Did you hear Samsonov's comments last night? It was like, I'm having a baby, man. It's almost as if this was such a secondary feel for him. And, you know, I'm not judging him. I'm not telling you it's right or wrong. I'm just telling you where their headspace can be sometimes. So, you know, it's a long year. You just hope that they can rebound back. They're going to see what they're supposed to believe is a very desperate Florida Panther team now, which the lack of play from the Pittsburgh Penguins, the drop off from Washington has put them totally in a spot where they can salvage their season. There shouldn't be a more desperate team in the league right now than the Florida Panthers. So where are the Leafs going to be able to match that Thursday night? That'll be intriguing.
Yeah, I mean, some big, tough opponents that have something to play for. A dangerous kind of schedule here. Florida, Carolina, Nashville, as you mentioned, and then Florida again. So, those are games that if you need to find a way to generate some intensity, those are some good opportunities. Luckily, the Tampa Bay Lightning have also not been putting together the best of performances. Another regulation loss last night to the Montreal Canadiens. Yeah. But when you look at how the Maple Leafs kind of got hemmed in, outworked from a team like the Islanders, who are a very strong forechecking team, like very much tough for the Maple Leafs to get out of their own end, and leading to their own errors and turnovers. Is that something that scares you with a team like the Tampa Bay Lightning? If the Maple Leafs get outworked and outforechecked, does that start to, you know, brew a little bit in your brain when you think about that first round playoff matchup that's just around the corner?
Well, listen, despite their hiccup as well, there's not a reason why that you would ever doubt that Tampa Bay is going to be a tough out. They've got experienced guys. They've got some of the best players in the world in Kucherov and Braden Point when they're on. Stamkos has turned himself into one of those leaders that we're going to talk about for the next 25 years. Nick Paul and Hagel has stepped up, and we figured out why they spent two first rounders on him to get him out of Chicago last year. So, yeah, I don't care what the record says in the last 20, 25 games for Tampa. They are exactly what you just described, Ailish, in terms of this heavy team that can come at you. So, again, it's paramount here for Sheldon to get his roster settled down. And right now, I think it's a tough feeling for the players to come in on an off day at practice or come morning of the skate and see the lineup posted on the board and wondering who I'm going to play with next. That needs to stop now. Once you start getting into these single-digit games next week, every game's critical in setting the mindset for that game one against Tampa Bay.
So a couple of reunions last night, one fresher than the other with Pierre Engvall facing the Leafs for the first time. But John Tavares, I mean, you heard the boos, and frankly, I knew it was a bad Tavares night because I didn't hear enough booing, really. We heard it when he touched the puck, but he didn't touch the puck all that much, at least it seemed. For you, what was it like facing your old teammates for the first time?
Oh, I had a horrible experience. My first NHL game where I spent like 5 consecutive training camps and preseasons with the Philadelphia Flyers. And then I get picked up on waivers by the Washington Capitals in my first games against all these guys that I just hung out with for like, you know, the last 6 weeks. And there was lots of chirping and it just didn't feel right to go and start running them and sticking them and, you know, but it's always emotional for anyone. And especially for John, you know, he is a very, you know, thoughtful person. And I do believe he is very emotional in many ways. And I don't think it's a good feeling for him from the moment he first stepped into the island and played against him to last night. I think it'll always be tough for John to go into New York and play against a team that gave him his start and was always considered the franchise player and face of that organization. But that's what being a pro is all about. Unfortunately, it didn't work out for him and the Leafs last night, but you know, he'll move on and he'll get another opportunity. And you check it off as one game and that's it. And you start focusing on Florida.
Did you ever get any boos or tough reception when you showed up to an old barn?
Ailish, I wasn't that good enough for people to really remember.
But you probably poked the bear a bit. Like, knew who you were.
Getting the penalty box and you're just getting beaked from like a 12-year-old kid.
Oh, my gosh. It was my first game, my first NHL game that probably chirped me the most. And, you know, I wasn't exactly going to go and fight him my first NHL game. But all good fun at the end of the day.
Mm. Did you put any money on the board for any of these? Because last night it was Pierre Engvall as well versus old team, Johnny T against his old team. Like, I don't know if Pierre Engvall's putting up money on the board, but he had 5 points in 7 games with the Islanders so far. I don't know if we missed him when you watched him last night, but that's a real thing, right? Putting money up on the board.
It is, but you know, not with my career earnings. I think I put up like a souvlaki dinner.
Nice.
In Greektown. That's more my style.
Well, it would have been Cal Clutterbuck eating the souvlaki last night.
He was really
his performance. Yeah,
he was really good last night, and he had some bad injuries this year, and he was off for a long time. But that guy was fantastic last night, and you hope that you know, an Achari or a Lafferty can have that same effect for the Leafs in the playoffs. And you know, in many ways, still, it's still a better look for the Leafs, I think, in the playoffs. The roster, you know, let's just check the results or the analytics to the side for a second. You know, watching Noel Achari, you know, hit Nielsen last night, and, you know, it's arguable, you know, or debatable whether it was a boarding call or not. But, you know, my first thought when I saw Achari hit him is like, isn't that nice for Leaf fans for change, not having it reversed and not having, you know, your opponent knock a Leaf guy into the boards like that. And, you know, that's sometimes it gets a little ugly sometimes. Sometimes you got to do things that, you know, don't necessarily look great, you know, in the scheme of things of fair play. But that's the look that you need. And I don't mind Achari and Lafferty at all. You know, in many ways, even last night, a goal for Lafferty in front of the net, mucking it up, Achari, you know, taking the man. Those are the things that I think we could take out of last night to say that, you know, they still should be looking like they're playoff ready more than they have in the past.
Yeah, and it was definitely a great fourth line shift that set the table for the Mitch Marner goal that temporarily got them back in it, but to no avail, of course, with the Islanders scoring very soon after that. It is a little tragic, though, that the one thing that seems to be set in stone, which is the fourth line, you know, had some moments last night. Maybe it wasn't Achari per se, but Kampf and Zach Aston-Reese having a couple issues on a couple goals. Ailish seems very unhappy with the play of Zach Aston-Reese of late.
Okay.
And I just want to juxtapose that a little bit to, like, you know, Cal Clutterbuck, who, of course, steps up in a big moment. Like, I guess the question is, do they have enough from that fourth line to make sure that it is useful? Or do you see them running into problems with Zach Aston-Reese maybe not giving you much other than, you know, trying to play Bash Brother a little bit with Noel Achari?
Yeah. You know, the one thing that stands out for me the most is, you know, a guy like Wayne Simmonds, who's still in the picture but isn't in the picture. And I find it kind of strange that he's only playing maybe once every 3 weeks. But when he does come in, if you ask me, I'd rather have Wayne Simmonds in the lineup than Zach Aston-Reese. So I think there's more of an element of his game in terms of having an effect on his teammates or finishing a check or talking to an opponent, you know, staring him down, knowing that I will hold you accountable if I have to. I think that stuff matters still. And for me, I'd have Wayne Simmonds in there more than I would Zach Aston-Reese. And, you know, that's just my preference. But Zach has to bring it every night on a fourth line. And I think it was the last shift of the game where I found him kind of blowing the zone. And I don't know if he was trying to pull a Willie Nylander and maybe, you know, go in for a breakaway somewhere. I lost him in my TV set. He was gone. And I'm like, it's the last minute of the game. You know, you guys are down by almost a touchdown. Like, where are you going? Just stay in your own zone. Make sure you don't get scored on and get the heck out of there. But we'll see how this all plays out as early as Thursday night.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. Wayne Simmonds certainly brings a level of toughness that the Maple Leafs don't have anywhere else. Could be a more of a playoff type feel down the stretch when they got to play gritty teams. They got to play teams that have something to play for. We see that a few times down the stretch. Kipper, thanks for joining us this morning.
Hey, hold on.
Yeah.
How's the puppy Bunkus?
Oh, he's really good. He's such a sweetie. He's very cute, but he's going through his little nibbling phase right now, of course. He's teething. He's only 9 weeks old. So yesterday he discovered that you can take toilet paper off the roll and run around the house with it. So we're working through it.
Nice.
Yeah, he's cute,
though.
That's
so nice of you to name him after JD.
Oh, yeah. Don't add to his ego. Ugh. I hope that the dog doesn't have the mouth that JD Bunkus does. You know, he's a bit more quiet, a bit more reserved. I would like that a lot. So appreciate it.
That's why I thought you named him after him, because either they look alike or they bark alike.
It's probably more like that then. But we're working on it. You know, he's a cutie.
You guys have a great day.
You as well. Thanks, Kipper. That's Kipper, real Kipper and Bourne. He's going to be off for the next few days, gunning, filling in with Justin Bourne.
And then he'll fill in for me a little bit next week with you.
That's right.
A lot of gunner.
Shuffling seats around here.
Over the next week or so. Do you have something to chew on? Brought to you by Great Canadian Meats. I have a short one.
We could double chew.
We don't have much time.
So is yours better than mine?
I don't know if it is. What's yours?
Mine's about Hyunjin Ryu.
Mine's about Shohei Ohtani. Can I over?
Yeah,
you can. We talk about Hyunjin Ryu at 8:30?
Yes.
Okay, because it's a quick one. Mm-hmm. This from Sarah Langs of MLB.com. Nobody else hit a ball harder or farther or threw a pitch harder than Shohei Ohtani did at the entire World Baseball Classic. So
yum,
threw the hardest pitch.
Mm-hmm.
hit the ball the hardest and hit the ball the longest. If you look at all the metrics, of course, across what? How many weeks of it? 3 weeks of the World Baseball Classic in two different continents and multiple stadiums. Is that not insane?
It's somehow not surprising, you know?
It's got to be a little surprising, though. There's no one that can come out and throw harder than he did. And he did it like he's normally a starter. He comes out of the bullpen, first time ever gets a save, and he's throwing harder than anyone else. Maybe he threw his hardest when he was starting games. I'm not really sure. He did throw a 102 in the ninth inning yesterday, though. It's wild.
He's just an absolute specimen.
He's a freak.
That was something to chew on, brought to you by Great Canadian Meats. We're going to talk about Shohei and the once-in-a-lifetime moment that we watched last night, the World Baseball Championship, the final game. John Morosi was there on the field talking to both the United States and the champions, Japan, Shohei Ohtani, the guy that just breaks every record that didn't know existed previous to Shohei Ohtani breaking said record. John Morosi, MLB Network insider, joins us on the other side of the break.
The best Blue Jays show out there, period. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Back on the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Woo!
Reminder to get your Wake and Rake submissions in. A tough night yesterday. Tough afternoon. 0-3 for the show. We're flushing it. It's like the Leaf game. Burn the tape. Move on. Move forward. We got to get one before I set sail, though.
Yeah, no WBC to bet on the overs anymore. Good thing we didn't do that yesterday.
Probably a good thing.
But we got Pacers at the Raptors. It's Canadian basketball night at Scotiabank Arena. So maybe you're betting big on any Canadian lineup.
Yeah, what does the Eilish-style parlay look like for that?
Canada
is it a homecoming?
Heavy.
Is it Canada just like filling the points, rebounds, assists, bucket? I don't know what the move is.
Canadian parlay. I'll put it together.
Okay, you'll figure it out.
I think we got our buddy.
Do we have John Morosi on the line?
We sure do.
We got him. John Morosi, MLB Network insider and the man who was right about the WBC all along. You were dead on. You were dead on, John. It was an incredible tournament. I'm sure you have stories upon stories. You might have a book in the works because you saw all that we saw up close and personal. Did it overshoot even your lofty expectations coming in?
It did. And good morning. It was an amazing 2.5 weeks of the journey. And let me tell you this, just the fact that we were talking before the tournament started and during the tournament, you know, wouldn't it be great if we got to see Ohtani on the mound and Trout at the plate? Wouldn't that be something? Nah, it can't possibly happen that way. And then it did. It's just baseball is something that cannot, I guess I'll just say this. It's impossible to script like any other sport or really even this one. And yet baseball more than any other game occasionally gives us these glimpses and moments as if it confirms to us that it was divinely created. And last night was one of those nights.
I mean, there's the saying, it's hard not to be romantic about baseball. We watched that final head-to-head showdown at the bottom of the, or top of the ninth, opportunity for history to be made. And we tried to figure out like a superlative for that final at-bat. And I came up with once in a lifetime. And I think that there's just no other way to really put it together, because for everything to align in that moment, and you jokingly, like, you had a great tweet, right? Oh, wouldn't it be great if it was the ninth inning and Shohei, and it happened. And it's just, it is pretty outstanding that we got to witness that moment. And I think it's got to rank up in the things that you've covered personally. By the way, you just did an incredible job too. We had such a pleasure watching you on the sidelines reporting. So just a hat tip to how great you did this whole time. It was really awesome to see you in your element there, speaking every language under the sun. I don't know when you're going to learn Japanese, but that's got to be next. But in terms of
that's the next one, Ailish.
I thought so.
You got three years.
All right. I wouldn't put it past you, but in terms of things that you've covered, like that's got to be up in the top, I don't know, 3, 5.
Yeah. I struggle right now to come up with one that I would put above it. Oh. And the reason is that it's twofold. Number one, it's the drama of the actual event, a one-run game between two of the most historic baseball nations in the world. Some would argue the two best. And then it came down to two teammates who are at the peak of their powers. And that's where I think it's important to appreciate this, that you know, last night after the game and even before it, we were hearing a lot of people say, well, I definitely want to play again in 3 years, and I hope they all do. But there's, we know this, and we've been conditioned to expect this with the Olympics and appreciate this, to where you can't always count on that happening. You can't always count on players being at the peak of their powers the way they are right now. And Ohtani is one of the great athletes in the world, and Trout obviously is as well. And to see them colliding in this way with two outs in the ninth inning, it's just, there are not moments in life that arrive like this. And have it be a packed crowd, 36,000, loudest and best venue that I've covered games in. It's just, it's remarkable. And I wanted to, I was there, you know, my broadcast location was right next to Team Japan's dugout. And so I was there listening and watching it. And I just basically said, okay, John, put down your microphone during this. First of all, they're not going to come to you now. They don't need to. Just let the moment breathe anyway. And just watch, because there was no need to think too much or try to game plan too much about what's going to be, what are you going to ask after the game's over? What's it going to mean? And what's he going to throw? No, just watch. And that was what I told myself. And I was glad that I just sort of drank in that moment. Didn't worry about getting video of it. Just sit there and watch. And it was magic.
Yeah. When we were trying to like talk about what it means, the superlative Ehlers saying once in a lifetime, and it certainly was once in a lifetime. Like we may never see those two ever again, go at it like the way they did. Right. We were trying to think of like, okay, the at bat, because when you think about legendary baseball moments, you think of the result from an at bat generally, right? You think about the home run or the great catch, all that results from an at bat. You don't necessarily remember the at bat. And I think I'm going to remember the at bat there, the pitches thrown, the three swinging strikes, which never happens with Mike Trout. Like, can you think of an at bat, specifically an at bat, that can even compare to the drama, the intrigue, the storyline, the stakes of that moment, six pitches between two legends of the game?
No, I really can't. And I think the reason why it was so profound was exactly that. It was the stakes and the teams and the uniforms. There was even that brief acknowledgement from Mike as he stepped into the batter's box, kind of like a little bit of a nod.
Yeah, that was
like,
cool.
Here we go, buddy. And it was just great. And I'll tell you this. I'll also say that one of the things that stood out to me the most about why it was so special is after the game, I spoke on the field with multiple members of Team USA who, of course, they were upset to have lost. That's obvious. But I've never covered an event where there was such gratitude for just being there. And on the losing side. Okay, like I was there, and there were players that came back out to the field on the Team USA side, and they were still so grateful to just be there. And that, to me, the reaction and aftermath was even more profound and just affirmed the magic of what we saw. Because for so long, this tournament story has been, well, how cool would it be if it becomes like what the World Cup is in soccer? I mean, I don't know how much more you can ask for what we just got. And the interest as well, I had a colleague who I met for the first time who came over from Spain, and we were just talking, and he said to me at one point, he said, esto es como un mundial, which means this is like the World Cup. It's for someone to travel from Barcelona and then say that to you about, you know, the sport that you cover in our country, and for someone from Spain to say it's like the World Cup is very, very high praise. That was pretty cool. And I'll probably always remember that moment, as it was, we in this tournament and international baseball, that we've arrived to being on a level of what the World Cup represents, what Olympic hockey represents in a best on best format. Like that was probably one of the coolest moments, just that one conversation. because it affirmed what we always believed could be possible and what we dreamed could be possible. And last night was what we dreamed could be possible, and it happened.
Yeah, World Cup, but almost even more authentic, if that makes sense. Like, the World Cup final borders on the Super Bowl a little bit, where it's very, you know, there's a lot of, you know, marketing people, and it's like an event for people that get to, you know, be the who's who, right? Like, that's kind of, well, there are some fans there for sure, but that felt so authentic in terms of fandom with different fans from all over the globe coming over and supporting their team. Like, it felt like an atmosphere that you really can't replicate, and it almost like ahead of its time, right? It hadn't got to the point where it's too commercial, where it could be spoiled just a little bit. Like, it was truly for the fans of the countries competing, which was very, very cool. And I want to ask you about Japan too, because we were sort of blindly assigning what it means to that country, and it was like, okay, is it Golden Goal? Is it Sidney Crosby for Canada in 2010? Is it more to that? In your sense, what does it mean to Japan to have won this tournament?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it probably 2010 Vancouver might be about that same level. That when you think back to what that meant to Canada, that's probably how they feel in Tokyo right now. And even remarkably, you know, I've certainly studied the history of the Summit Series and learned about that, and it's on a lot of levels. There's certainly some common threads to where, you know, work and school was obviously happening during the day as the final game of the Summit Series was in Canada, and people just weren't working. They weren't. I mean, I know yesterday, so 2 days ago for the semifinal was actually a holiday, so everybody was home from school anyway. But I think yesterday was even more profound in that regard about people. I was texting with one of my college roommates who was saying, like, yeah, at work, like, we're not really getting a whole lot of work done. He's working in Japan now. It was just it was a moment in time. And I'll say this. I feel like, and to your point, I think it's very, very well put. I mean, there are so many things that happen in life that maybe are almost in some ways too big, right? I mean, the Super Bowl is so big, and this still retained its authenticity. And there, I'll say this too about international baseball, especially Latin American countries and Japan, and the way the way the fans are during the games is a show unto itself. It's that respect is like going to a World Cup major soccer game, and I'll say that, you know, certainly the U.S. Cuba game got tense. There were protesters on the field. That was a sort of a heated moment. But I think with that notable exception, there was just such collegiality and support between the nations, to where even the U.S.-Mexico game, all the intensity of that regional rivalry, and there was such support and love in the stands afterward and even during it, where you would cheer really hard for your team and then you'd go back and there would still be that support and respect. And obviously Japan's fans take it to a different level. I mean, in terms of the trumpets and so there's a cheering section and a song for every player that you saw probably out in left field, the trumpets going and the way they were reacting. It's just, it's remarkable. And the amount I'll tell you this funny story too. We were on the field after the game, Lars Nubar's mother, who of course is from outside Tokyo. She was on the field and we were speaking with her. Hale Reynolds and I, my friend and colleague, we were speaking with the Nubar family about an hour after the game. And a Japanese television crew calls over to her and waves her over. And she walks over to do this interview after the game's over. And there was a huge ovation for her from like 30 people around on the field still, including the TV crew and their technical crew, just like appreciating her. There's just appreciation was kind of the word of the day. Like, there was just really, really cool moments. And again, even on the U.S. side, like, I've never seen a game where the losing team has been out on the field kind of milling about with family after it was all over. And that happened. So it was pretty cool. It was a deeply, deeply, deeply grateful and a profound moment to have witnessed. And you're right. It sort of makes us can't wait for the next one in 3 years, but also don't rush to 3 years from now. Just kind of live in this moment and appreciate what we just saw.
Well, I want to ask you about 3 years from now, though, because
sure,
I think
let's do it.
There's a lot of, I hope, positive momentum from this. It was spectacular. And everything you talked about, those moments, like, I don't know if they can be replicated, but is there a way to make the event even better moving forward? Is there a way that more players buy in now because of how incredible this World Baseball Championship was and the classic that we just saw? Does this do anything different for maybe Canadians, but, you know, players all across that are watching that might want to be a part of this in 2026?
Right. No, it's a great question. I think the twofold. Number one, could we see a little bit more pitching on the U.S. side and some of the, you know, like a Nick Pivetta for Canada, others that were missing and were sort of, whether for health or other reasons, where their absence was noted and felt? Sure. That's always a part of the tournament, and I think will be. At the same token, I don't know, you know, beyond just watching this tournament and talking, now that you have these ambassadors of, you know, this was Shohei's first classic, this was Trout's first classic, the ability for these players to go back and share with their teammates what it was like. And I think even too, you've got Freddie Freeman, who played for Canada again, for his mother Rosemary and for his father Fred Sr., what that meant. You've got now these great ambassadors. And so even though Mets fans might say, yeah, it was great, but we wish we had our closer. And I understand that. But at the end of the day, this is something that the players love to do. The fans love to do. And when you have Mike Trout saying it's my favorite baseball experience ever. And you have Ohtani saying, like, I think paraphrasing here, but like greatest moment of my life. Okay. Well, when you've got those two guys saying that, I don't know if there's anything much more that any of us need to really say. You either get it and understand why it's so special, or you're not paying attention. Because I'm not really sure if it's possible to pay attention and not realize how special it is and understand that. So that's the first part. The second part is to then watch the growth in some of the more some of the newer nations to the international baseball scene. You know, Italy reaches the quarterfinal. Great Britain finds a way to qualify for the next time around. The Czech Republic, you know, you've got Ohtani wearing a Czech hat when he shows up to the U.S. I mean, there are some pretty profound moments that I think in a lot of ways are you can arrive and make an impression more quickly in this sport than you can, I think, in soccer or hockey. And part of it is obviously the eligibility rules are different. You just have to prove that you're eligible to have the passport as opposed to actually having the passport. That's significant, but it's still meaningful. And trust me, it was meaningful. I mean, as an Italian American, it was meaningful to see Italy reach the quarterfinal. It was meaningful to see what a lot of these nations have done. You know, Mexico reaching the semifinal was profoundly impactful to that country, which is a very proud baseball country, and they're going to be hosting a Major League Series in a month. So the timing, the moment in time where all these things coalesced, Ailish, is really pretty profound, and I hope that we keep revisiting what this classic meant and means on a continual basis to growing the game around the world.
Hopefully the FOMO or the fear of missing out is still really strong and survives 3 years, right? Like, I'm sure there are a ton
of... I'll remind them.
Yeah, yep. I'm sure there's a ton of major leaguers right now that are thinking, wow, I turned this down? What was I thinking? I missed the chance to be on Mike Trout's team to see Shohei Ohtani up close and personal in a championship game, and I'm out here playing 162 largely meaningless games if I'm not on a good team. Like, I'm sure there's a lot of players sort of regretting their stance on things, and hopefully they'll be reminded of that by not just you, John, over the course of three years. In terms of like the actual game and the matchup, I didn't really know what to expect, right? From Japan, we're, you know, waiting for them to come over. We didn't see any of the Japanese games beforehand. They're kind of on when we're on, so we weren't really able to watch them.
Right.
And I didn't know what to expect, right? Are they going to be jet lagged? What's the matchup going to be like? How could anyone hang with the United States in that lineup? And they go out there and they ultimately outslug the Americans. Were you a little surprised? Because like, it's kind of like the MMA analogy, right? Like, you got the kickboxer versus the wrestler. They're not that different, Japan and the United States, but they're different. Did you expect something different? Did you expect the Japanese to outslug the Americans? I think they both hit two home runs, so maybe not outslug, but went toe-to-toe with them in that regard. Like, Did anything surprise you about the actual game last night?
Truly, no. And the reason I'll say that is this, is that when you have to face a series of pitchers that you're not familiar with, that's often a problem for a ball club. And that's true if it's game 80 and the Blue Jays are facing six relievers from Tampa Bay they've never seen before. And it's true yesterday that when you face new pitchers who are both really talented, which Shota Imanaga is the starter, and then certainly the pitchers that came in after him, but also very aware of tournament baseball and how to keep you off balance for your lane, and then pass the baton to the next pitcher. You know, I've seen Japan wins; they win international tournaments. Right now, they're the first country ever to hold the WBC championship, the Premier 12 championship, which is the successor to the Baseball World Cup, which sort of happens in the off years, and then also the Olympic championship at the same time. They are those boxers who like have all the belts all at once. That's what Japan has. Okay, so they're really great to begin with, and they're really great when it comes to tournaments. So I think that if you look back at the box score last night, the U.S. walked a lot. Their pitchers, they're having a hard time throwing strikes at different times. Japan played a really clean game. Japan played an excellent defensive game. And by the way, like Genda, the shortstop, Sosuke Genda, who's really one of the most beloved players on that team, and Hideki Kuriyama, the manager, said to us yesterday before the game, he felt like that Genda is the best defensive shortstop in Japanese history, which is not lightly said. I mean, that's a big deal. And he's playing with a broken finger on his throwing hand. And so, like, you saw there was a very clutch bunt that he put down in the game against Mexico. And I remember thinking to myself, like, here's a guy that we hockey people can appreciate. You know, like, you're playing with a broken finger. And obviously, you know, throwing a baseball requires a lot of things to go right with your hand. And he's just doing it, and he's doing it at this elite level. And this guy could be a great hockey player too. So it's just for me, you just understand the investment and the awareness of the Japanese baseball culture in both the way they play, the way they prepare, the way they honor the game. I've shared the story before. I had a chance before they played Korea at the Tokyo Dome in the championships in the Premier 12. 3 years or 4 years ago now, I was there, and to watch them take infield is like watching the ballet. It's like high art. And so I have such appreciation for the way they play the game. And I got to tell you this funny story too so before the game, we had our production meeting as one of the rights holders. We were doing the world feed. And so we were part of the meeting before. So it was Fox and us and XM Radio. It was like a small group of people that were doing the broadcast that had a meeting with both managers. That was true during the course of the tournament. And so Kuriyama-san, who's this wonderful person and this great spirit about him, we asked him, I asked him before the semifinal game, I said, Kuriyama-san, is it possible that we could see Ohtani pitch this week? And his eyes kind of lit up as he's getting the translation from the interpreter. And he's like nods his head, and he gives the answer, and the answer comes back to me through the interpreter and says, the answer is, I have had this conversation with Shohei, and for now it will remain between us. And I just said, like, I was like, oh, he's pitching. He's going to pitch. There's no doubt about this now. And so just like the way he said it, and the coolest part about it too, is that Kuriyama was the manager when Shohei began his professional journey, and he was the one that encouraged him to be a two-way player. So when you know that in the back of your mind, that he sort of helped give him this germ of the idea to do this and to be a two-way guy at this level, and now he's the manager, and now he's got a chance to pitch him in the ninth inning, there was no way in the course of human history that Ohtani was not going to pitch in that game last night. Like, he was going to pitch. And so to watch it all happen was just an absolute treat.
Very, very cool. It was definitely an awesome experience watching the World Baseball Classic. I love your ballet analogy too, watching the Japanese players take infield. Yeah. I mean, that's at the very top of my sports bucket list, mm-hmm. is to go watch a game in Japan, and I hope I get to witness that ballet one day. But for now, the World Baseball Classic will do. We appreciate your time this morning, John. I know you got up early for us, and you've been on the grind as of late. So we definitely do appreciate it, and you did a great job once again over there at the World Baseball Classic.
Justin Ellis, my pleasure. Thank you so much. Thanks for bearing with my day after the last game voice here, getting through it, but I appreciate it. I appreciate your interest in the tournament as well, and all the great questions. Really a special day, so thanks for everything. I really appreciate it.
3 years, we can't wait. That's John Morosi, MLB Network insider, and the first to knowing just how good the World Baseball Classic was. We got to go to break. We got Joseph Cachero on the other side. We'll talk a little Canadian basketball night. That's next.